Welcome back to Practically Intelligent. As always, I'm your host, Sanan Ozdemir, and with me is the lovely Akshay Bhushan. How you doing, Akshay?
I'm pretty great, man. I'm excited to chat with our guest.
Who is? I'm kidding. I got this. Aman. We are talking with Aman Khan. If you don't know who he is, Aman is, well, first of all, he's a wonderful person, so easy to talk to, and such a great teacher. He's currently the director of product at Arise AI, but before that, he was at Apple, Spotify, Cruise. You'll hear a lot of examples around self-driving cars in our chat today. Most notably, these days, he is evangelizing, creating content, courses around AI PMing, product management. And while that might sound vague and like there's a lot of sprawling aspects to it, really what Aman is teaching is how do you build effective, scalable AI-powered products in our modern age of LLMs and generative AI? What's changed? What hasn't changed? And most notably, where can people find the right resources to enhance their products from day zero? So without any further ado, let's go ahead and jump right in.
Awesome. Aman, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. It's exciting to be here.
Awesome. Well, maybe just to sort of ground us, could you sort of describe the conceptual tenets or kind of key pillars of an AI PM?
Yeah.
And what you're seeing? You see a lot, but I'm curious, if you had to distill those down to kind of core conceptual tenets or pillars, what would they be?
I love the term. I love how you asked that question, because it's very clear I'm on a data science podcast and not a product podcast in many ways, right? Like, I think, okay, so maybe to zoom out, just, you know, by way of background, what is an AI PM? Let's just forget about the AI part of it for a sec, right? PMs care about, their job is to ship end business value. It's not to build products. It's not to ship AI stuff or features. It's to solve customer problems. And I think to refocus on that for a sec, like, as long as you're working on customer problems and responsible for that end business impact, and that can mean working with teams, collaborating with teams, getting stakeholders aligned, prioritizing, talking to customers, synthesizing their feedback, and literally writing code or writing documentation to make sure you've solved the problem, to me, that's some flavor of product management. And I think my observation and kind of what we're seeing in the space now is that that role is changing because of the access to technology that PMs have today. So AI PMs can really, in my sort of world, they're really kind of three flavors. You're either using AI to sort of do the things that we just talked about, which is solving customer problems. And so you might be an AI powered PM. There's this part of the market is growing like crazy in terms of PMs that just start getting more and more upskilled. So for instance, you know, I'm starting to help PMs learn how to use Cursor and Claude Code for more than just prototypes, but really understanding workflows end to end and being able to kind of ship an early version that you can go and like take back to your team and figure out, okay, should we ship this bigger thing later or show it to a customer and get feedback? So it's like, how do you actually just convey and communicate effectively as a product manager using AI? That's the powered part of the AI powered PM. But then you also see platform and product PMs. So by that, I mean like an AI platform PM is someone who's thinking about their AI strategy across the business. Should we have XYZ model or vendor, or should we have these best practices baked into how we build AI features in the first place? And then downstream of that is someone who's actually incorporating AI into their product. And again, like, I'm a pretty strong advocate. If you're an AI PM, you're a PM at your core. It's not like, oh, I'm not doing product management anymore. I'm an AI product manager. I'm going to put that on my LinkedIn bio and Netflix is going to pay me $900,000 because I have AI PM in my title. Like, that's bullshit. I think instead, you should really view yourself as an AI X PM, meaning you're using AI, you're building around AI, if it makes sense for you to do that thing. And I think the reason that you're hearing so many product people talk about AI PMs is because it's really clear that there's an entire sort of part of this landscape where people aren't seeing what the right product experiences are because they haven't tried to use the tools themselves. They're not really sure how to get started. And I think that's the gap today. It's just, we just need more people with AI intuition so that we can finally move on from the term AI PM. And then you're just a PM that's using AI or building around AI and you go back to PM. So I think eventually we're going to see this pendulum swing back to like, you're just doing product management at the end of the day. It just so happens that your product is going to have AI in it just as much as it's going to have a database in it. You're going to be doing product management. You're not a Google Docs PM. You're just a PM. And so
right, you're not like a website product manager. You're just a product manager who happens to be working near AI.
Yeah. I think what's pretty wild is like, if I truly talk to PMs even now today, it's like so few of them actually fall into those three buckets that I just talked about, right? Like, oh yeah, like our business has some part, like there's some team working on like an AI feature, but I'm not really a part of it. Yeah, I've heard of Bolt or Lovable, but I'm too scared to try it. I haven't tried it out yet. I don't have time. I'm too busy. Yeah, I have no idea like what's the latest model you were talking about. I haven't even heard about that, you know? So like, I think that that's the gap today. And that's the opportunity if you're listening to this and you're a product manager, thinking about how to get closer to the tech, at least in this case first, so that you get more ideas for what to go and build later, is really the opportunity.
It's super helpful because I think you tied into the things that don't change around product, around commercial intuition. You even touched upon elements of the job that don't change. But there's two things that you lightly alluded to that are changing, which I think is the way folks prototype and the way folks evaluate AI yeah. products. Maybe we could take one by one, but maybe you can say, because you just work with so many companies, I mean, I'm kind of curious, you even have this phenomenal post we'll link to with regarding Bolt and how they prototype, but maybe you can talk a little bit about, we can take prototyping, but what you're seeing and how PMs change the way they prototype and different opportunities for folks to upskill here.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, okay, I have a little bit of a story here. Maybe we go into the story of like the word prototyping for a sec, right? So like by way of background, I actually have a background in mechanical engineering. And I came from the world of like physical products early in my career. And in the physical product world, in the hardware world, prototyping meant like you show up to a meeting with like literally cardboard like glued together to explain a mechanism or a concept. And people would like pass the prototype around in the meeting. Everyone would kind of be like, huh, okay, it kind of looks like this. Oh, it does that. And or it's like some balsa wood, like probably people remember doing that stuff in like school. What do you do at the end of that meeting with the prototype? Like, do you go and show it to customers? Probably not. I mean, you're going to go throw it away in the trash. And I think what's been interesting is that for the past however many years in software, PMs have been removed from code. Anytime they needed something visual, they'd go to their designer and be like, hey, can you mock this thing up for me? And the designer would go, and now we have Figma. So they would use Figma and design this thing in software. And now you have something you can pull up into a meeting and take a look at for your execs. When you actually want to go to a customer, you take that Figma prototype and you give it to your engineering team. And you're like, hey, just build like a quick version of this in like a week. I need to show this thing tomorrow. Well, guess what? That whole part of the job you can now do as a PM. There's actually no reason you can't, because the tools are accessible when they weren't really, like before you'd actually need some education in using the tool. You would need to know how to code, but now you can just open up Cursor. You can open up Claude Code. And as long as you're comfortable asking the right questions and debugging and understanding how systems work, at least at a high level, or at least have the curiosity to go one level deeper, you'll be able to do that job of building something that you can show up to a meeting with, convey your idea visually and in a physical way. And at the end of the meeting, once everyone's aligned, you can throw that prototype away. Like, it's okay to have disposable prototypes. Like, don't be too married to an end idea or to an end design, because the whole point is that you can keep iterating and evaluating, okay, how do we actually go and ship this thing that's going to solve a problem? So this is a long-winded way of saying, I think we can finally start prototyping again. Like, it's finally at our fingertips here. And if you're a product builder and you're not using prototypes to convey ideas like every single day, that's a missed opportunity because it's just so much more visual and tactile for people to understand where you're coming from. And I think that the more we start getting there, the more we're like, oh, actually the prototype's not enough. I need to go back to this other format. Great. I mean, you just had a realization that maybe documentation is the right way to convey the idea, but you can go turn it into a code prototype if you want to. The point is that that's another skill that you can kind of pull out of your inventory of skills that you can use as a PM.
That makes total sense. And I think the concept of a prototype in a lot of ways hasn't changed, right? Because like the whole point of the physical prototype, the balsa wood, I mean, my buddies who used to build like thumbprint I remember they're like YC interviews, wires everywhere. And you know, it's still kind of similar with software, right? You have like, well, here's a Figma, the button looks like it clicks, but it doesn't super click well. And you can still get the point across. And I think that's really the main point. Here's where I'm curious, the switch kind of between physical and digital in the modern era. With a physical prototype, evals almost becomes like, well, does the prototype kind of work at least? You know, do I get the point? Obviously, it's not ready to ship, but, you know, does the light up when I press the button? Yes or no? With a digital prototype, call it from cursor, maybe even lovable, however you make this prototype, what in your mind, in your kind of framework, how do you think about evaluation evals? Do you even think about evals that early when you're prototyping, or at what stage should everyone, including a PM, be thinking about and working with evals?
Yeah. So I typically see three workflows when it comes to getting an AI product out the door. It's typically three. And it doesn't even have to, when I say AI product, it's really any product if it's using AI to get there in the first place. But let's just imagine that there's AI in it for the sake of this discussion. So there's really the first version, which you're describing, Sinan, which is, I just need to get this prototype out there. And like, I like to like, I think we've all kind of been here at some point, but let's put on our hat for a second. We're a PM at XYZ successful company, you know, in the space. Let's pretend it's Uber for the sake of argument. And our VP of product is saying, hey, everyone, we're going to take a hack week and come back with ideas. Okay. So go off, build stuff, come back. What should we go ship next? So you're PM on this team and you're thinking, okay, I've got 1 week. Let me get this thing out the door. Well, you're going to go back. You're going to go to cursor. You're going to build something to communicate an idea to your team. And you're going to vibe eval it, right? You're vibe coding on the nights and weekends or here during your daytime office, you know, your hours. And you build this thing and you're like, okay, it works. You show it around the office. People are like, yeah, that kind of works for me. It's kind of weird here. You know, you go and demo it to the VP. The VP's like, great. Okay, go ship it. Green light. Go figure out what it'll take to ship this thing. And then you spend the next 3 months in development hell. Because what you've realized is this little vibe coded project has so many little nuggets that you need to go and like expand further. Well, what happens with this edge case behavior, right? Like, and we make it more tactile. Like, let's say you want to go and ship a new version of the like customer support agent in Uber. And all of a sudden you start showing it to more people. Maybe you want to show it to an end customer. One of the customers says, hey, I want a refund for this thing I bought on Uber Eats, and the bot says, sorry, you're not eligible for a refund. And the customer gives that bot a thumbs down. And then on top of that, they can say, well, please give me a refund. I feel like I earned it. I'm such a loyal customer. And the bot's like, you know what? Because we know that these things are, you know, they're sycophantic. They're gonna.
They love to be helpful.
Yeah, they love to be helpful. Your system prompt, you're a helpful AI agent, and it's like, okay, you know what? You're a loyal customer. You get a refund. So, like, what just happened in that case, right? In one case, the customer gave the bot a thumbs down for doing the right thing, and in the other case, the customer gave the bot a thumbs up for doing the wrong thing. And when you come back 3 to 6 months later, and you've shipped this thing into production, and all of a sudden, you're measuring. You think you're measuring the right things. You wrote an eval, you did the right thing. You're like, hey, let me check that this bot is always helpful, right? That's what we're supposed to do. And the evals are going up and to the right, but your business metric is going down, right?
The thumbs up are going up and to the right.
Exactly, Exactly. And you've aligned your eval to thumbs up because that's what you're supposed to do. That's data analysis. That's workflow too. That's like, I wrote the eval. I did the thing I was supposed to do. Well, then you're kind of like at this head scratching moment with your team, which is, did we go through this process the right way? We wrote the eval, right? Workflow one is vibe coding, vibe evals. Looks good to me, ship it. Workflow two, we wrote the eval. We think it looks good. We did a little bit of analysis. It's fine. Go hit ship. But then workflow three is what we're trying to get our customers to, which is you actually have evals that you're using and you trust in development and through production. And those evals actually map to your business metrics. They map to the things that you really care about at the end of the day. And they're leading indicators, not lagging indicators, of what the performance of your AI system is going to look like. And to get there, you have to do things like launch, you know, a canary test to a small subset of users. Make sure that your evals are fully aligned with your human feedback and your subject matter expert feedback. And I think that's a big step that people miss because no one wants to go and label data. But the best teams we see actually doing this stuff come together once a week. And it's usually a meeting of like PMs, engineers, maybe your subject matter experts, your QA experts. Get the right people in a room and just go in and look at data. Look at 10 rows of data. Spend an hour if you have to. And just see, like, in these cases where these things happen, are we making the right decision with our system or not? And I think if you can answer that question and come to the answer of, we have the right data in place to go and build evals. And when we talk about evals, we mean like automated systems to evaluate the output of your LLM or agent. Then you're actually getting somewhere. Then you're getting to a world where you can actually sort of trust this thing to go out at scale. And I think that there's maybe we'll get into this in just a sec too, but I think that this type of agent where it's directly tied to revenue, you're putting it in the critical path of your business. There isn't a human intervening unless there is some like terrible incident and you have to escalate. Like, that's where evals really matter. They probably don't matter as much if you're just vibe coding, vibe evaling, and you're just going to throw away the thing at the end of the day. Like, I think even if you're just doing a quick prototype, like, did the prototype work or not? If you're building a coding agent, is it actually going to impact revenue at the end of the day? Or is it just inference that you're billing for? Do you need evals for that case? Like, that's up for debate. But for businesses where you're sticking AI in the critical path of your business, you should probably be measuring the quality of the output. So that's like workflow three, evals in development and production. So
I would even one up that by saying, even at the largest scales, you can see these kinds of, I guess in the workflow two that you mentioned, OpenAI's sycophancy debacle in late April of this year.
Yeah.
If you read their postmortem, I mean, they don't mince words. I mean, that's honestly one of the things I like most about them is they literally said, we used your thumbs up and thumbs down feedback way more than we ever have in training this version of the AI. And turns out that made a worse AI overall. And so it's kind of mind-boggling for a lot of people to say, well, whoa, I didn't realize, a lot of people didn't realize they were even using thumbs up, thumbs down in the first place. I'm like, of course they are. Why would they give that to us if they weren't going to use it for something? And B, it was pretty surprising, obviously, to OpenAI to say, well, hey, we thought, you know, if you liked it, you would want to see more of that. But like you just said, just because you liked it doesn't mean the AI did the thing the developers and creators wanted the AI to do. So that mismatch is not even just business metrics. It can go just even as simply as it's a mismatch between your user experience. Your user liked something that you have to sit down and confront that and say, that was wrong. What our users like is wrong. And we have to find those discrepancies, which can be kind of a hard pill to swallow because you're saying the customer is not always right very specifically in this case.
No, you're absolutely right. But like in all jokes aside, like I think that that's like part of, you know, the thing where one test you can use to kind of get out of the sycophancy mode of your agent, even if you're probably use this as a consumer when you're playing around with these tools, right? You get that you're absolutely right. I always hit ChatGPT back with, no, give it to me the other way. Like, give it to me like in a more real kind of way.
Give me the devil's advocate kind of.
Yeah, play devil's advocate. Give me the other side. And you know what's shocking is like you hardly see that type of testing. It's kind of like a red teaming type of test on your agent. And
Anthropic does it a lot. I'll say that.
Yeah, but imagine that your business actually building around this stuff as mm-hmm. from an enterprise perspective. Like, why is it that we always align these agents with like, you're a helpful AI assistant doing XYZ, you're always gonna, like, you're designing for happy path always. And I get that that's what's gonna help you get out the door. But your evals should cover the set of negative examples too. So we talk often about golden data sets, the examples we should never regress on, right? But what about examples that we wanna actually improve on? And that's, I think, where things get really interesting is that, you know, if you go back to like the self-driving space and how we got to like Waymo actually working, well, you design a test set that is representative of your overall driving domain. It's called ODD. And all of the self-driving car companies that got started in this way, you get a representative sample of how people drive normally, and you use that to train the model. But we all know that like when you drive in a city, crazy stuff happens, right? People jaywalk. There's cars coming when they're not supposed to, breaking a red light. Someone's crossing the street when you don't expect them to. And so what you end up building is test sets or scenarios for those edge cases and the weird things that you see on the road. And then some researchers go back and they train the model. In this case, you're actually developing a model from scratch, right? For self-driving, you're like training the model, you're fine-tuning. And you're trying to make sure that you catch those scenarios and improve on these weird kind of edge cases. That's a lot of the same principles that you're going to apply to this new agentic AI product world. It's just that probably instead of training the model or fine tuning even, you're going to do something called context engineering, prompt tuning. You're going to manage context essentially for the agent. You're going to make sure that it's handling these scenarios the way it's supposed to. But to do that, you need to get a set of those scenarios in the first place. So you're going to error mine. You're going to get examples to mine on top of. So you have your golden data set that you always want to make sure you're doing well on, which is representative of what you're going to see for like 80% of the time. But then you keep building these error data sets and you want to use those to make sure you're always improving on the, like, you know, human gave us a thumbs up, but we gave them back their money when we shouldn't have or something like that.
One thing you said is at the start is, and you sort of implied, in 5 years, there's not going to be AI PMs and PMs. It's just going to be PMs, right? This is the new skill set, and that's going to underline anything. And I think one thing that in the evals discourse is like people treat it as its own technical, like the actual curation of the data set as evals versus the broader practice of this is AI. Like it for it to work, this is about application quality. You know, it's much more broader than just this, like, you know, specific test case you're writing, et cetera. And one thing, there was this fantastic post you had, and nestled in it was these rituals that great PMs can shepherd. I think a lot of times PMs, I started my career in product, and a lot of the great PMs that I learned from, it kind of sounds crazy, but it was aligning the engineers, shepherding, and talking about some of those touch points and rituals you can set to save the team time, to really make sure folks are on the same page. You loosely touched on it, but you have these touch points, I think you talk about in one of your blog posts, of like, how do you co-author prompts? How do you curate data sets? I think a lot of times when we just talk about evals, we just talk about like the very technical nature of it versus these rituals that I think in 5 years, we're going to be talking about every product team doing, right? You have to have eval fluency, but really, I think for great PMs to get promoted, that's table stakes. You need to know how to prototype. You need to know how to write evals. They're going to just be really great at organizing these rituals and superpowering the engineering team. So you talk a little bit about these and you touch on it, but what are some of those rituals when you take evals at a broader set that great PMs are doing around evals with their teams? What are great practices you see these, you know, next generation of AI PMs, these rituals you see them setting up? You talked about golden labels. We talked about just looking at your data with your team. Yeah. What are you seeing them do in terms of collaborative practices with their engineering team?
Yeah, for sure. And maybe to set a little bit of context here with terminology, we've been talking a lot about like evals I'll just kind of qualify. I think evals are data you use to improve on your model or your application in this case. And evals are basically the way that you measure the application performance and use that data from the measurement to improve on the system. And that can come in a lot of different forms, right? It can come in the form of like code checks. You know, if you're, yeah, it's kind of interesting. Like there's this interesting thread online of like, you know, the best AI applications out there today are just built by these like these cowboys that are writing Claude code and Cursor, and they have like 10 examples and they're like, yep, looks good to me. I just ship. But like, for sure, they have to make sure that like code compiles, and that's a test. That's a unit test or a system test, system integration test. But then you actually have to make sure that the agent, like the AI system, can like interpret strings correctly. And in this video where Boris, I think like the Anthropic team talks about like, oh yeah, I just look at like 10 examples and hit ship. But he even mentions like, oh, like I every day I log in and you could see that Claude Code is having a hard time reading these strings or having a hard time pulling data from a place. Like that is a form of evals, which is he's trying to go improve on these subsets of scenarios where Claude Code isn't looking at data well. Like he maybe doesn't have a test set, but he's looking at the scenario he wants to improve on, and he's going to go and improve on it. And he's going to know when he's fixed the problem, because that's what he's evaluating for. He's evaluating for Claude Code can read these strings correctly and can grep and find the right string. So I think that like, I think that to some degree, we might be doing in a slight injustice to the term eval by making it feel more technical than it is. It's really meant to be a collaborative process on your team. And it's something that I think that if you're a PM, you know, if you're a PM that's responsible for the end business impact, then your job is to get the right people in the room to look at that data. And so to answer your question, Kakshi, like I really see like this job of doing evals means, do we have the right data in place? Is it representative of what we care about? Are we measuring the thing that we should be measuring for our business and moving the right metric? Like defining all of those things, getting your stakeholders on board at upper and lateral level, and then actually getting people to carry out the work needed to get there by labeling data, building test sets, measuring your impact every time you ship code, and trying to figure out why certain situations regress. Like that is the work that goes into evals. And if there's more to it than that at times, like error analysis, or if it's just vibe evals, like that's up to you and your team to decide. But the point is to like look at data to make a decision.
I was going to say, even in that example you gave, when he was like, oh, we only do it across 10 examples, that's a test set. It's not a big one.
Right. Yeah.
But it's still, you're still doing evals, and that's great. Like I think this is kind of funny when people don't want to admit that they're doing evals. They're like, we're cool, we don't do evals. It's like the second you do one example of like, let me just say hi and make sure it responds back, congratulations, you've done an eval. Like that, right. And that's great. Yeah. And that's really the mentality I try to instill. Like I have a 9-hour evals video on O'Reilly because it covers so many different aspects of what evals mean. It's a latency. It's cost even is a form of eval. Is if you're trying two different models and they're performing at the same rate and one is more expensive, that's going to be a bottom line metric that you need to keep track of. I even went so far at a conference, I gave this example. I said, okay, simple example. You have a chatbot recommending electronics in an electronics store. Okay. User asks for something. The AI gives an aisle and says, go here. I think you'll find some good stuff, or here's a product. AI gives a product. Was the AI correct? That was it. That was the only thing I asked. And then I got people saying, well, if they bought it, yes. Okay. That's going to be a small sample of people who buy it. And so someone else said, if they buy something in the same aisle as the product that the AI recommended, that's still a purchase facilitated by the AI. A third person would say, it's only correct if the manager says it was correct. Like it was basically human annotated after the fact. A fourth person would then say, it didn't ask a follow-up question. That's not enough context. The AI should not have given a recommendation in the first place. And I stop them and say, this conversation that we are now having at this conference is what you should be having with your team.
Yeah, absolutely.
The first part of evals is you all agreeing what is correct, what is right, and what is wrong. Because I guarantee that at least one other person in the room won't agree with you, and you have to come to that consensus, or at the very least say it out loud and be explicit before even moving on to a test set generation. I guess I'm curious, how does that resonate with you? Like, does that make sense? Is that how you see it too?
Well, I've been doing a lot more. I mean, you know, my day job is working at a company that helps build products to help people at their companies building products, AI products, like actually run evals. So we build like infrastructure for evals, right? But a lot of my job is actually spent talking to business people and product people. And they're like, hey, Amon, can you come in and just like give a talk to our product team and explain how we should do evals? And I go in and I kind of do this, you know, like, hey, here's what evals mean. Here's examples. You know, what questions do you guys have around this? And they're like, well, can you just explain like how we should do them? And I find myself feeling more and more like, sorry, nerdy example here, but like Yoda in episode 5, where he's just like, I can't help you find this thing. Like, you need to go.
And you got to do it. Journey, you got to walk through that cave and come out telling me what an eval is.
You got to go through the cave and you got to go through the steps of figuring out what matters most and measuring it. And you know what we often find on the other side of that cave is, well, I don't know how to even get this data. I don't know where it lives. Like, I think we're logging it somewhere in BigQuery, but I don't know how to query for it. I don't know how to pull it down. I got to go ask someone. We just use synthetic data to make decisions. Like, that's when the alarm bell goes off. And I'm like, step one, make sure you have the right data in place and then call me back and we can take a look at it. Because I think that that's usually what is the feeling where you've basically, if this is you, if you're listening to this right now and this resonates, like, you've effectively outsourced evals to another team. You just don't know it yet. And that's probably something you should think about, which is like, you've probably outsourced it, or someone's not doing it, or they're doing it in a way that you don't even realize. And so the first step is to just getting sure you have data in the right place. Do you have the right data to even look at it and make determinations of whether or not your agent is doing the right thing or not? Once you get there, you can start doing all these like sophisticated, really amazing methods of like error analysis and LLM as a judge and all these cool things you hear about, you know, teams doing. But I really do think that like step zero we often find is just people aren't looking at the right data. They're not looking at data holistically across the team.
I think it really is just that, it's a simple step. Where's your data? Looking at it. And I find it so funny, this like discourse, which is like, Claude Code doesn't do evals. I'm like, well, pre-training is kind of evals. Like, they're model companies, right? Like, they are right. Obviously looking at their data, et cetera, stuff like that. If you are shipping an end user application, you're not a model company, you're not a code gen company. You're right. You're outsourcing. Either you are outsourcing, if you are not having those discussions and have an aligned approach, you're either outsourcing that to someone on the team that you don't know about, or outsourcing it in terms of a bad customer experience. And what's right. Product's job? It's to own customer impact and customer experience. So totally. I found that discussion, that kind of last couple of days, very funny, because if I talk to you and Sinan, who are, you know, seasoned veterans, they're just like, this isn't LM as a judge. You don't need some crazy fine tuning. Just like, where does your data live? Like, and that's right. The discussions I find when you all, when, you know, Sinan comes back and we talk, he's just always saying most people are not even at the phase where they have. And if they are looking, what are the rituals they have around that to look at it and consistently and continuously improve their application? So I couldn't agree more.
I would even say that last part you just said, Akshay, is for me one of the bigger aspects of evals that people seem to kind of like, not forget necessarily, but one of the big points of evals is not just to say, should we ship this? That is the big part of it. Did we regress somewhere? Are we seeing something? Is it getting better? And that comes back to the, Amon, what you said is your test set, your internal benchmark is not just these things should work. It also has to be, we want this to work, but we know it doesn't. So it's part of our test set, because we will always know over time, have we finally solved this one random edge case? It's that proof for that a PM should be able to, you know, very be proud of, to say, right. Given this, and a lot of my clients, I force them, you know, given this 80 size test set, we're only doing 60% of them correct are at any given moment. For example, next week it's 63, next week it's 65, next week it was 64. Don't ship that one. Great. Next week it was 68. Next week it was 72. And they could show this, and it became this, the conversations became easier going forward, right? Because it was no longer a debate of, well, is this better? Is this new prompt better? Is this new model better? It's no. We all agreed. We walked through this cave together and we all agreed that this test set is covers what we think is important. And if we all agree, a higher number should mean better. end of story. And it just really facilitates this whole process of improvement in my mind.
Yeah. And like, I actually, I'll add one more note on that, which is, I actually think it's okay to push back on, does this number mean we're getting better? If you find that it's time to reiterate, you know, like that's iterating on the eval itself, right? Like that might mean you need to iterate on what good means. And that's like a healthy debate to have as long as you're doing it with data in the first place. And so we actually see two loops here. It's like a lot of the time when we're talking to companies, talking to customers, we're not just trying to show how you can iterate on your agent and use data and evals to improve on the agent, but you can actually error mine. And this is again, like how reinforcement learning works in the self-driving space. You error mine, for example, to improve on the evals themselves. So you actually have two loops going. You have one loop that's improving on your agent and what you're designing for in your application, but you have another loop going to make your judge better and better as well. So you're actually raising the bar as you go. And that might mean like, oh shoot, we have to cut over to this new eval judge. Our 90% satisfaction eval is going to drop down to 80. Can we stomach that? Well, yeah, because your judge got better. So like this, there's actually two loops going at the same time that as you get further and further, you're going to, it's going to feel pretty real.
It's funny you mentioned that in the concept of kind of LLM as a judge. And just to clarify, in my mind, there's kind of a separation there. For what people usually call LLM as a judge, I tend to call rubric grading, LLM rubric grading. You give it a rubric, you give it things you care about, and you generally ask it to give you a score on those different aspects. Versus what I would consider the standard classical LLM as a judge is you give the LLM two options and you say which one is better. Maybe you tell it what you care about, but you're basically having it pick between them rather than voting on one particular. But either way, it's actually funny because every time someone brings that up with me, like, oh, we're using rubrics, oh, we're using LLM as a judge, I ask them a very simple question. I go, are you evaluating that? And they go, what do you mean? And they go, that's a prompt. You're using an AI to give you an answer. How do you know the judge is correct? And they go, oh my God. And I'm like, uh-huh. Every time you ask the AI something, that's another dimension of evals. In my latest book on applications, I do a whole chapter on experimentation. And one of them is I build three different rubrics and they all give across five different LLMs. They all keep giving different answers to me. And I can easily cherry pick examples where it said this was 100%. I disagree. That was a 50%. I disagree. So even the concept of evaling, if you are offloading it to an AI, that also has to be evaled. And it becomes this kind of catch-22 almost of how good is our judge?
Yeah. And I think like I'm going to wear my product hat back on for a sec here. And
please.
I'm very curious, Akshay, on your thoughts on this as well, because what you end up doing is like, if you're a product person, you're hearing us talk about evals and you're like, oh my God, this seems like a lot of work. Like we're not doing half this stuff. Like this sounds like a whole quarter, maybe two quarters. Like I just need results today with this AI agent. And I heard this great analogy this morning, which is LLMs are, because they're non-deterministic systems, next token predictors, they're excellent at serializing and deserializing business context, basically. It was kind of a pretty good analogy in my mind because it's like you're transforming your raw data, your business context into a decision that you need to deserialize the other end of. And what you're really doing is measuring how good that thing is at deserializing the context. And I think that a lot of this comes down to like effort and impact back to that type of study. Because let's say you have a really meaty problem, right? Like you're trying to design this like efficient frontier of picking the right problems for AI to go and solve. Like you can go pick, you know, freaking the equivalent of out of the money roadmap items and try and go solve those and bang your head against the wall, but then find that the LLMs aren't good enough for you yet to go solve that problem. Or you can pick the easy stuff and it's like not going to move the needle on your business. So as a PM, you have to find this efficient frontier of picking the right problems to solve with AI systems that I think that truly, as you use them yourselves and use them to build prototypes, build real products for yourself, you'll find what's doable and what's not, and then go and tackle those problems in the context of your business And I think that that's what is probably the highest leverage thing you can do as a PM right now, is develop that intuition of what can we do right now without us trying to boil the ocean with, like, you know, thousands of hours of engineering time going into like error analysis and data for like a non-deterministic system, but something that is super valuable and something we can stand up and show real impact for sooner rather than later. Cause you're going to get pushed by, like, we have to be practical here. You're going to get pushed by your business to go faster and ship this thing. And you're not going to have weeks or months to go do evals. You're going to have to figure this stuff out on the fly. So it's better to try and design your project to bake in, you know, something that's tractable, that's going to people care about, but that isn't so big that it's doomed for failure and so small that no one cares. I think that's the really hard part in a lot of ways.
That's super well put. I think the thing I'd push, you know, you could kind of see when Cursor and Lovelux are coming, okay, this is a really changed product. And now we're here talking about it. People, you know, are sort of riding that wave. Everything you just said is 50 to 100 times more important in an agentic world. Knowing right. when you have a efficient frontier and baking that eval and knowing, like, you know, whether it's going to hallucinate, what is the tone the agent is doing in your prototype itself you are building, and having that awareness and that intuition. We talk so much about product sense, right? Of like, great PMs just have great product sense. How do you build that product sense for an agentic product? Like, it is, you know, if you look at the, you just where the world is headed, I think that is just going to be what you just said is going to be essentially the craft of product is great right. prototypes. Everyone is going to have, be able to build something in 3 years with Claude code. It's going to be a, you know, table stakes. That intuition and how you build it is looking at the data, having a good understanding of what are the evals for your business. That second loop you talk about, Amin,
right.
is just going to be so crucial. I think that's the wave we see. And when I talk to our startups that are automating a ton of crap, that is the intuition their founders have, both with the domain problem and how they talk to their team and their product sense is built from. It is this sense of the frontier for each individual feature and their roadmap. And so I just want to say, what everything I'm is talking about, when I see early successful startups that are scaling and it's sort of they're the next paradigm, it's becoming not just table stake. It is the practice and craft of product. Is your product sense will be built through evals, and you will articulate that through evals.
Yeah. And I think that totally resonates. And I think I can even, you know, I think part of where this might go is like, well, how do I develop that product sense in the first place? And I think that there's really two things you can do. There's really like two things you can do, but also one sort of like high level observation on the space. Like, one is that the observation is like, no one really knows. Like, I think everyone is just trying to figure stuff out and see what works. So like, anyone who's giving advice, I would be skeptical until you've actually tried the thing yourself, which is actually point number two. Like, try the products out yourself. See what has what really has product market fit and works really well. I'll give you a hint. There's like a handful of products out there that have like true product market fit using LLMs. A lot of products that automate parts of your business and are better because, you know, they automate some part of some traditional enterprise that is true business value. But what can you use today as a consumer that has true product market fit and just feels like magic? And then two, just try to reverse engineer that and see how it works. Peel it off. Like, you know, again, kind of coming back from like mechanical engineering world for a sec, we have this concept of teardowns. We would buy a competitor product and we would literally take it to a saw and like a bandsaw and chop it in half and just see what components were inside. And you're like, oh, they packaged it this way. They used this.
Good for morale too, I assume.
It's very satisfying, but it's also like, after you've done a bunch of these, you're like, oh my God, you know, be careful. You don't like wreck the thing. But I think once you tear something open, you peel behind, you know, the first layer, look underneath the hood, you come back with more ideas of like, here's what we should be doing. What if we tried this thing? What if we try to add a planning step, an explicit planning step, and make a to-do list? The agent needs to make a to-do list before it goes off and does reasoning and taking actions, right? Like, what if we just tried that and see if that made the agent better? What if we hooked up tools through an MCP instead of raw API calls? And I think that this is this type of stuff that gives your up-levels you and your intuition, but also up-levels your team. And actually, to your previous question of what are some of the rituals, make teardowns part of your ritual. every week try an AI product or try the one you tried last week, but come back with an insight of like what they did to make that thing feel amazing. And I guarantee you, like that's a learning opportunity for you. You're going to have your VPs in the room. I guarantee it because they're curious. I know this for a fact, like, and no one knows how this stuff works except for the people building it. And you're going to have a lot of people in your business caring about, hey, you know, how should we go and learn about Claude Code across the whole business? Believe me, I'm not seeing that enough. And that's a huge opportunity, I think, for PMs today.
Well, in the spirit of learning new things and constantly learning about AI and AI PMing, I want us to end this by saying, first of all, thank you, Aman, for being here. Where can people go to learn more from you?
Yeah. And again, thanks for having me, guys. This one was a lot of fun. I love how you let me kind of work in these weird, wacky analogies in here. So that was great.
We're weird, wacky people.
Yeah, it's always fun to chat with you guys. So you can find me on LinkedIn X. LinkedIn is just, you can just search my name, Aman Khan. And then amanK.ai is my website. That's where I'm going to post and sort of share whatever I'm working on. Sometimes it'll be educational content. Sometimes it might be real product stuff, but follow along if you want to see more of what I'm working on.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Aman.
Yeah. Thank you guys. Awesome. Thanks for having me.